Welcome back to Keeping Up With Data.
And what a special episode we have today. Firstly, joined by our MD, Simon Paul Hare today, which is a special appearance. And then, of course, the amazing Jill Newby from the Black Dog Institute. Welcome, Jill.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, guys, what we're talking about today, I think, is harnessing the power of AI for mental health solutions. So I'll hand it over to Simon to sort of kick off this conversation, but we'd love to know more about your role, Jill, at the Black Dog Institute and what you guys are doing at the moment.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a research program lead at the Black Dog Institute, and I'm also a clinical psychologist. So my main role is leading a program of research into depression and anxiety in adults and early adulthood. And I also co-direct the Centre of Research Excellence in Depression Treatment Precision. So it's a very big mouthful, but we call it CRE Precision for short.
And just to kind of take a step back a little bit, we've been working or partnering with the Black Dog Institute for probably 5 years now. So every year we'll do an event of some sort to raise some money for the Black Dog Institute. And I know a little bit about what an amazing job the Black Dog Institute does, but can you give some context kind of from a bigger picture what the Black Dog Institute does?
Yeah, sure. And we're also really grateful for any partnerships and all the generous funding that the partners like yourself provide, and also the community fundraising that we do as well. So Black Dog Institute is a mental health research institute. It covers the lifespan from childhood to older adulthood. And we're focused on trying to improve the prevention and intervention and treatment for mood disorders, anxiety disorders, and suicide prevention.
Okay. So to kick off, when it comes to mental illness, everybody has their own, I suppose, like specific needs, and everybody's different. Can you give a bit of background and context to that when it comes to managing mental health and mental illness?
Yeah, as you said, everyone's different. So each individual experiences mental health or mental illness in a different way. So one individual might experience depression in a way that their symptoms are depressed mood, lethargy, fatigue, low motivation. But another person sitting right next to them might also experience depression, and they might experience agitation and anxiety and suicidal thinking. So no two individuals are the same, and that's partly because it's really complex and multifaceted. So there are a range of different things that kind of contribute to mental illness and also contribute to treatment response as well. So it can be culture, can be gender and sex, it can be thinking processes, biological processes, and other things that can contribute to these like vast differences across individuals.
And just going back to your role within the Black Dog Institute, how did you end up becoming interested in such a topic as mental health?
Well, I kind of started out of high school. I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I went into psychology because it sounded really interesting. I really like kind of English and writing, and I also like maths and science, and it was a really good combination of the two. And I landed in psychology, and then I stuck with it because it's really fascinating. And the work that I've done since I graduated from university is really focused on digital mental health and combining that with face-to-face psychological therapies. And I really saw the need for accessible treatments that people could do anytime, anywhere, regardless of where they live and how well they could travel. And also trying to make treatment more affordable and accessible for people. So, yeah, it's been really interesting coming out of uni and then sticking with it and doing the work that we do.
So how many years have you worked in that world now of mental health?
So I studied for 8 years to get my degree and a PhD. And then after that, I've been about, it's probably 10 to 15 years after that.
And in your experience, what are the challenges that people face when it comes to finding a mental health solution for an individual?
I guess I probably need to start with explaining what mental health solutions are available for the community. So if you have a mental health issue, I'll say depression and anxiety because that's really what we're focused on at the moment. Your options are psychological therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy, or there are some other therapies like mindfulness-based interventions or medications. So antidepressants can really work well for depression and anxiety. Some people might access lifestyle interventions like exercise and diet and nutrition to help their depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. But there are a range of different challenges. Like, first of all, it's confusing. There are in cities, there are so many options available that it's just hard for any individual to navigate that system. It's really complex. People don't know where to seek help. They don't know what kind of help they need, and they really don't know where to start. Whereas in other areas like rural areas, there's a lack of choice. So there's actually not much treatment available or support. So you might have one GP in a small rural town, maybe if you're lucky, one psychologist and no psychiatrist, but you might be friends with a psychologist in that town. And right. so it leaves yeah. you little option for treatment. Mm-hmm. So there's the choice and the options and the confusion around that. There's also access barriers. So it can be very expensive to seek therapy and treatment for depression and anxiety and other mental health conditions. One psychological therapy session might cost you out of pocket $100. A psychiatrist appointment might cost you a few hundred dollars, but people don't need one session. They need multiple sessions over the calendar year to help them recover. And so that gets into the thousands. And if you're a family where one person experiences a mental health condition, another family member is probably more likely to experience a mental health condition too. Right, okay. So those costs really add up and it's very expensive. And there's often long wait lists because we actually don't have enough clinicians to meet the demand for treatment. So mental health issues are rising in particular cohorts of people, especially young people, but there's simply not enough trained workforce to meet the demand in the community for good quality, accessible treatment.
And what would be the age group of the you talked about the younger generation there where it's rising, what age group in particular, and is there any context into why it's kind of on the increase in young people?
Yeah, it's quite unclear about why the mental health prevalence is rising. So we know that the last National Health and Mental Health and Wellbeing Survey showed that there was an increase in prevalence of depression and anxiety in the 18 to 24-year-old bracket. The prevalence rates were similar compared to the last National Health Mental Health and Wellbeing Survey that we did in 2007. Mm. I think there's a variety of reasons why that might be the case. Some of the research that was done on was done during the midst of the pandemic and shortly after, and I think the pandemic really negatively affected young people. It affected everyone, but young people in particular. It affected their schooling, their social life, their opportunities. It changed the way we work and learn and educate and socialize. So there's just a range of different factors that probably play into that about why those prevalence rates are rising.
Do you think we're still feeling the aftermath of the lockdowns, and is that still playing out?
I do. Because any chronic stressor, which that really was for everyone, to different degrees. So some people had major chronic stress and then other people had maybe lower levels of chronic stress. That's going to exacerbate pre-existing kind of tendencies towards mental health issues. And so we are seeing the aftermath of the pandemic, even years after. We did see kind of an increase in depression and anxiety and mental health conditions around that time. Mm-hmm. The other impact of the pandemic was really the change in the way that we socialize and we work and we study. So for young people going into university or other kinds of study, that's completely changed the way that they would have studied compared to before, and reduced the social connection that they probably experienced, where they can connect with other students and other people their own age. Work is the same. So work changing from in-person to work from home also has that negative effects. It has positive effects, but it also can have negative effects, particularly for young people who work can be a really important opportunity to make like lifelong friendships and connections.
Yeah. And I know it tends to be men we hear a lot about in that over 40 category, but in the younger generation, is there any kind of research on whether it's boys or girls who are more affected?
Boys and girls are affected in different ways. Yeah. So boys are more likely to experience externalizing behaviors and externalizing conditions. So that could be more oppositional kind of disorders, substance use disorders, those kinds of conditions. Whereas girls and women are more likely to experience depression and anxiety. And around kind of the teenage years is when you start to see that difference. So the increase in the prevalence or the rates of depression, anxiety in girls, and boys are staying the same. So there is a bit of a gender difference, and a really important one that we need to research more to try and figure out how we can prevent that escalating rates of depression, anxiety in girls and young women.
So Jill, you were involved in the founded a research center of excellence last year in March 2024.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a mouthful to pronounce, so I'll leave that up to you to tell us about that. But could you give us a bit of background to what that is and how it came about?
Yeah, so it came about through many years of research at the Black Dog, UNSW, and a partnership with Deakin University and Macquarie University. So over several years we've done, and colleagues have done, research into the prevention of depression, anxiety in young people, different treatments, including digital treatments, and innovating through AI. In depression treatment precision. So it came out of like a background of many years of research and collaboration with those different universities. But the centre now, we applied for what's called a National Health and Medical Research Council grant. So that's the grant funding body that funds a lot of medical and mental health research. Yeah. And so we were lucky enough to get that funding, and it's a virtual centre. So it brings together teams of researchers who have a variety of different expertise from UNSW, Black Dog Institute, Deakin University, Sydney University, Macquarie, and then QMIR Birkhofer in Queensland, and some institutions in internationally, including Harvard.
Yeah.
And what we're bringing together is experts in different areas, so digital health, AI, data science, lived experience, clinical psychology and psychiatry, to see how we can improve the treatment and prevention of depression.
Okay, yeah, that's amazing. In terms of, I guess, where you guys are now after, you know, launching this new Center of Excellence, you've got the grant. Have there been any key findings that you can tell us about that you guys are already seeing as a result of this progress?
Yeah, we're doing research in a range of different areas. So looking at how we can use AI to personalise treatment for depression, personalised treatment recommendations. We're looking at how we can use digital phenotyping or mobile sensing data to see how whether we can get more understanding of people's behavioural patterns and physical activity patterns, and see how that might influence treatment response. So one of the key studies that we have done that we're hopefully about to publish, it's kind of very close to, I think, being published, is a study that we did a little while ago on a new clinical trial methodology. So we were really focused there on young people with mental health issues, and that was in university students. We know that's a really peak time for the onset of mental illness, around that 18 to 24-year-old bracket. And so we did a trial where we compared different lifestyle interventions for depression and anxiety and distress. So that was physical activity, mindfulness, sleep intervention, and a control group. And the novel part of that trial of this, we used a completely new AI trial methodology to figure out which treatment might work best for different individuals. And we found really exciting findings. So that AI methodology helped us to determine which treatment might work best based on a student's severity levels. So we saw some interventions work better for severe symptoms, and other interventions work better for less severe symptoms. So it really paves the way to more personalized interventions for these young people who are really in need of treatment.
That's awesome. And just taking a step back, Jill, but digital phenotyping for our general audience at home, what does that actually mean, and what sort of technology does that sort of help with?
Yeah, so I guess to take another step back, we don't have good objective markers of depression or anxiety or other mental illness. A lot of it's really based on self-report. So you might fill out a questionnaire and to index your symptoms, or you might do a diagnostic interview with a trained clinician to see whether you meet criteria for a diagnosis.
Yeah.
So this is actually a completely different way of collecting data. Most people have mobile phones and smartphones in their pocket. Yeah. They use them for hours per day, especially young people, but probably all of us. So we're looking at ways of using that passively collected data from the mobile phone to track a person's profiles and behaviours. So there's a lot of data that you can collect over the mobile phone, your location, so whether you spend a lot of time at home or whether you have a variety of activities during the day, your sleep patterns, so whether you have short sleep or whether you're sleeping way too long, or whether you're awake multiple times through the night. It can track your physical activity patterns, so how many steps you do during the day, and a combination of all those kind of activities to get a bit of a marker and a behavioural profile of individuals. So digital phenotyping means looking at the digital marker and providing a picture of what that client or person's profile is. And we're looking at using that data to see, can we find early markers of depression before it's even started, so we can intervene or prevent depression from even starting in the beginning? can we use that digital data to influence, to mark treatment response? So can we use the digital data to see, okay, is this intervention working for this individual? Or if not, we would switch them to something else that might work better. Mm-hmm. And can we use it as a marker of relapse? So we know that depression is a highly relapsing condition. So once you've had two or more episodes, you're very likely to experience another episode. And getting in early before you've fully relapsed is really important to get back on track quickly. So we're looking at those kind of markers to see, can we help kind of detect those symptoms and mood deterioration early to get people better and more on track as quickly as possible.
That's awesome. So you're collecting these large amounts of data over many, many years and then sort of running these models to help predict and sort of track how mental health can be either addressed using sort of digital technology.
That's
really cool. I'm sure our audience at home would love to sort of understand more around sort of how you're able to apply those statistics across the different age groups as well, right? Because different, I guess different groups would have different proclivities or different markers that would tell them, you know, you're more likely to have this or you're more likely to have that.
So you guys are working on that at the moment to help that.
Yeah, that's right. And it's really complex data, and I'm not a data scientist, I'm a psychologist. So it's trying to work together with a multidisciplinary team who has completely different expertise to me. Sometimes we speak in a completely different language, but it's trying to bring the expertise together to try and answer this problem. And it is the complexity that's really important to research because, you know, factors like age could make a difference. Whether you've got a chronic health condition might make a difference. You might be less mobile and you might have like lower activity patterns, but that might be good activity for you. And yeah, we're trying to use this data and use AI to figure out whether we can improve and shift the dial for depression outcomes.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I suppose in terms of, I guess, the continued role of AI in creating these new solutions. Mm-hmm. Can you give us maybe some insight as to what you can see in the future happening, if anything, and like where this technology can take us going forward?
I guess AI has many different families. No, there are AI models that can be used to process complex data patterns and gain insights into these huge data sets that the human eye can't see. Mm-hmm. So I think there's one kind of field that will be very useful for to potentially subtype depression in a way that we haven't before. It's a very complex condition with so many different variations. And so I think AI can potentially be used to spot those different patterns and potentially subtype depression into multiple conditions. There's another component of AI which can be used potentially for intervention. So we already know that people are going to chatbots like ChatGPT for mental health support and advice, and also for advice around relationships and connection. Some people use it a lot per day to get that sense of social connection. That's already happening, but I think there's a lot of potential there for a safer version and an ethical version of generative AI to help provide individualized and personalized support for people with mental health issues. We need to make sure that there is research alongside these tools because there are instances where these AI tools can be damaging and harmful for individuals, but on the whole, the majority can be really helpful. So I think that's another area that's really interesting and probably the future of mental health support and advice. And then there's other kind of AI methodologies in the way that we test and compare different treatments for mental health issues.
I was going to ask, is there an AI tool that's shown to be better for advice around mental health or anybody who's struggling or suffering? Is there a kind of a one that's shown to be better than the others at the moment? There's so many out there, right?
Yeah, there's so many out there. And the challenge with the funding system at the moment is, first of all, it's really hard to get research funding to do any research. You know, the success rates of grant funding is about 5 to 10%. So even the best people doing research, you've got a 5% chance of getting research funding. Mm-hmm. The research funders don't often provide funding for head-to-head comparisons like that, of like one tool versus another. So we have to use other techniques like systematic reviews to figure out which one might have the best evidence. Mm-hmm. At the moment, it's too early days, I would say. There isn't actually, as far as I'm aware of the literature, there's no evaluations of those kind of off-label use of things like ChatGPT for mental health treatment. It's more people are using that already. But there are some programs that are available which have been designed with and by clinicians and have those safeguards in place to make sure that where the tool is managing risk and making sure a client is safe, it has safeguards in place to make sure if a client is deteriorating or their symptoms are worse or their symptom profiles don't kind of match using a digital tool is a good idea. So there's programs called Wiser, Wobot, Yalpa. They're more UK, US based. And they've been shown to be beneficial in improving depression and anxiety. But I wouldn't say, I don't know whether there's any head-to-head comparison. I don't think there are.
Okay, still a bit early.
Yeah, it's very early days in that evidence.
Okay, absolutely. You sort of answered one of my questions there around safeguards and data protections and things like that. If I'm someone who's probably seeking that sort of help, you know, do I have to worry about my data and, you know, sort of the governance and how it's used to help your research? Like, I know that's going to be a question to people, like, because now more than ever, our data is out in the world and it's being used by hundreds of companies and different businesses. So with the Black Dog, you know, how are you guys helping to make sure this data is being put to the right use and not sort of shared?
Yeah, we're very strict around the use of the data that we collect in research studies and also in clinical settings. So we have like quite strict privacy policies. We're governed by ethics committees and clinical trial governance in UNSW and whatever hospital settings we might work in.
So we have quite strict on data protection and privacy around the data that we use and collect, because it's really important. It is highly sensitive information and we don't want that to be released anywhere, because that had potential implications for work or for insurance or other things. So we do our best to keep that data safeguarded.
Yeah.
I would say that when people are using digital tools or providing their sensitive mental health information to companies that
may not have that really strict sets of ethics that we do at the universities and mental health research institutes, they need to be careful and really understand that by providing that information to tools like ChatGPT or other AI tools,
that is used to train the models, but we don't know where that's stored. It's often not stored in Australia. That data is being used for other potentially commercial purposes if they're using other digital tools that are owned by companies. So I think it's really important for people to be aware that they are providing sensitive mental health information and they would want to really know, well, if that data got released, how would they feel about it and are they comfortable with that happening?
Absolutely.
There is a risk.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of, I guess, where you guys are now, Jill, like, what's next? What are you guys working on currently in this center of excellence that is either groundbreaking or we should know about as an audience that maybe wants to either donate or get involved with the Black Dog Institute?
We have a lot of different research projects, so I don't really want to overwhelm you too much with the different projects that we're doing. All the way from depression in women to different interventions and digital phenotyping. So one of the projects that I'm leading over the next year or so is a new clinical trial, which is comparing a digital psychological therapy with a digital lifestyle intervention to see, can we use AI to figure out who might benefit from a psychological therapy versus who might benefit from a lifestyle intervention that targets their sleep and their physical activity and diet? Because if we could figure out before they even started an intervention, we could match the person to the right treatment for them and not waste their time and money and all the heartache of trying a treatment that won't work. So that's what I'm really excited about in my program of research. And we've got a range of different other projects that are really focused on shifting the dial for depression. So at the moment, we know the best recovery rates from depression treatment are around 50%, which is all right, but it's not great. Relapse rates are again 50%. So even if you recover from the best available treatments, you're likely to relapse within a year. 50% will relapse within a year. And there's a huge time period between when research is done to when it's in the clinic. So there's about a 17-year gap between
research findings and when that is translated in practice.
So we want to focus on trying to improve those statistics, bring down that time from research to practice, improve recovery rates from 50% better and reduce relapse rates for people with depression through different research projects.
17 years, that is a long time. Yeah.
It is. Yeah, it's too long.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially when we have such innovative tools and exciting possibilities for treatment innovation. 17 years is not good enough. If it's, you know, if it's one of your family members or your child or your parent or, you know, your best friend, that you want to get the best available treatment right now rather than waiting 17 years and your symptoms are deteriorated. So
yeah, definitely. Wow. And then sort of the final question, Jill, if we want to support this cause, if we want to help the Black Dog Institute, donations go a long way, and where can we go to do that, and how can we sort of support your team and the Centre of Excellence?
Yeah, you can go to the Black Dog Institute website, and hopefully there'll be information that comes along with this podcast. If you're interested in the CRE Precision, our centre, you can sign up to our mailing list, and we provide monthly newsletters to talk about the progress of our research, profile our research team as well, because it's made up of really great humans that are doing this work, and also where we're heading as well. So that's another way that you can kind of keep up to date with the work that we're doing.
Absolutely.
Can I ask one question? A random one. But we have a lot of parents who are our listeners, and in that kind of 40 plus bracket, in that world of data, if you could give one piece of advice to those parents who've got children and teenagers and stuff, is there any like one tip or insight that you could give around how they could do a better job to support, I suppose, the mental health and well-being of their kids?
That is a huge question.
I know. I've thrown you under the bus there, haven't I? Sure. Yeah.
And this comes from me being out for 2 hours last night with my son. So it's like, it's a very good question, and I'm not sure whether I have a really good answer. But that's, I would say, if you think that something is going on with your child, get help early.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
There are. We've talked a lot about the problems with the interventions that we have and the opportunities, but there are really great practitioners out there who can be very helpful, treatments that are effective and can change people's lives. And so if you get in there early,
get ahead
of it, you can make a huge difference and completely change the trajectory of a young person's life in a positive way. And if that young person's life is better, the whole family system will be happier.
Absolutely. And I don't know if it's just me, but certainly people, my kids, certainly they seem to be a lot more transparent and open with talking about it now. It's a lot healthier world where people talk about their feelings or how they are or mental health, which can only be positive.
Which is amazing because, you know, there's a lot of research in bottling feelings up and how that can, you know, maybe it works in the short term, but can it really be counterproductive and quite negative for some people over time? And so the fact that they are more open and willing to talk about it and sharing and getting social support is a really important progress. And it's amazing. Like when you work and or around young people like that, I just think the future is exciting because they are so willing to talk about these things, and they're going to be the ones that change the mental health landscape as well. So,
We're going to be doing our bit of precision sourcing. Sorry, I jumped in there. Got excited. We're going to be doing our bit of precision sourcing to support the Black Dog Institute this year. We're going to be doing something called Climb for Lives, which is we're going to be climbing the highest 10 mountains in Australia in 48 hours.
Wow.
And
what are the 10?
I don't know. One of them is called Kosciuszko. That's all I know. And we're also going to be, I don't know if you've seen the Netflix documentary 14 Peaks about the Nepalese guy who climbs 14 mountains over 8,000 meters. So we're creating our own in the office, and two stair climbers that are going to be running for 75 hours constantly, 24/7. So we're going to be doing our own 14 Peaks.
That's amazing. And,
so if you want to join the team, let us know.
Thank you. That sounds so exciting. Thank you so much. We're so grateful. Nice. It makes such a difference to all people who are kind of suffering in Australia. So appreciate it.
Maybe you could come back on in the future and update us on.
Yeah, I'd love to.
How the research
in a couple of years, and then we can tell you where we've been and what we've done and what we've learned.
Just not in 17 years.
No. I might be retired in 17 years.
Who knows?
All right.
Thank you so much for coming on, Jill. Really insightful discussion about the use of AI within mental health solutions, but also what the Black Dog Institute is doing to help tackle this issue. You can also head to our website, precisionsourcing.com.au, to make the donations. We have a Black Dog Institute page where you can actually click on a button and register and help out. But otherwise, we will hopefully see you in not 17 years, maybe in a year or two,
yep.
And have you back on. But thanks for coming on.
That sounds great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.